Welcome to Chronicle the Podcast. I'm Anthony Everett. Last week on Chronicle, we aired Colleges in Crisis, which covered an unfortunate and growing trend in New England among small colleges. Since 2016, more than 20 New England colleges have closed, consolidated, merged, or were acquired by another institution. If you happen to catch the show, we sat down and spoke with John Marcus, the higher education editor for the Hechinger Report. His background and experience added greatly to our show, and he's going to join us a little bit later in this podcast to talk about some of the things that we touched on in the on-air program, but also some of the things that were left on the cutting room floor. But first, we're joined by the producer of the College in Crisis program, Kathleen Kiley. So Kathleen, fill us in a little bit on how this came to you, and we'll talk a little bit too about your own personal connection to college and the debt that comes along with it. But first, how did this come to you as a topic for Chronicle?
Absolutely. Well, I guess if we'll talk about, I was on the show in 2014, and John Marcus also was an expert on that. He's been covering this for a while. And he did a report recently about all of these colleges, like Mount Ida's closed, Newberry's closing. You know, why are these colleges going through this struggle? And he wrote wonderfully about that. And I'm like, okay, this is something that's really going to affect our economy. This is something that affects all generations. You know, this is something that needs to be told.
So I know we talked to John throughout the show. We're going to talk to him later in the podcast. But we also talked to students and we talked to administrators. And were they reluctant at all to talk to you? Were they willing to talk to you, particularly some of the institutions that are either closing or in some level of crisis?
I was actually very worried about that. You know, you get your assignment and I'm like, oh, are these people going to want to talk about their failing institution on television? Probably not. But surprisingly, and I think Chronicle's reputation of being fair had something to do with that, especially when I explained what we were trying to do. We're not, you know, going at an angle here. We're telling your story. And I think Hampshire was a little, you know, I'm not sure if we can, you know, make the time, but they eventually said yes. And that, I mean, that we can talk about that for sure. That ended up kind of shaking things up a little bit right after our interview with Hampshire President Miriam Nelson.
Right. We had just finished interviewing her, and she was explaining the crisis that Hampshire is under, and they were looking at strategic partnerships. They were looking at trying to remain independent if possible. And within a week or two after our interview, she had resigned.
We interviewed her on a Friday, and the following Friday at 4:30, I received an email that she had resigned, effective at 4 o'clock.
Which threw us into a little bit of a tailspin.
Yeah, I was like, oh, well, what now? I have this beautiful sound with this wonderful woman, and she is no longer a college president.
But we worked around that. I mean, just a little behind the scenes. It was obviously still germane to the program. She was a college president. She was a college president at an institution that was in some level of crisis. And much of what she said was about the broader picture of why Hampshire and other schools have gotten to this point.
Exactly. And when I went back and listened to what she had to say, she also, I think, very smartly alluded to the crisis that she personally was facing behind the scenes at Hampshire College, dealing with these people that were not supportive of her plan.
So Miriam Nelson's office actually had been occupied by students. She hadn't even been in her office in something like 6 months or so?
Yeah. So in January, students started protesting, and they did almost, you know, that peaceful sit-in kind of protest, and they had sleeping bags and they were camping out there and they had no intention of moving.
In her office, she hadn't been able to get back in there and was still trying to manage this crisis, really, of what they were going through.
Yeah, when we interviewed her, I thought it was strange that we weren't in her office until I realized what was going on. You know, she was sitting in a conference room with an iPad. That's what she'd been working on, an iPad.
We also talked to the president of Newberry College, which is closing at the end of this year. This will be their last graduating class, and he was willing to talk to us as well. None of them seemed shy about at least explaining what had led to these decisions to close.
I was very appreciative as to how candid he was. He really, he did his best to try and get that college to continue, and when it didn't work, he said, okay, let's take care of our people. Let's take care of our students. And he came up with a plan. And unlike Mount Ida, where they closed in May and they announced to students mid-April that they were closing, they had about a month to get it together. Newberry said, okay, we're closing. We have a whole semester. And I really, you know, they took the admissions staff and they turned their admissions staff into transfer coordinators. And they really helped their students. And I think the students appreciated that.
We've talked about the administration. We've talked about the presidents. But the students are the ones, in many cases, who are just left in the lurch. And while some of the schools do help them with transition in some way, they're still struggling to find a school that will, A, have the programs they're interested in, B, honor the financial aid or whether it's merit or scholarship or need-based that they've got at the institution they're currently enrolled in. These are complicated things for a freshman, a sophomore, or a junior in college to figure out.
They just went through this whole process in high schools. You know, and if you're a freshman, you quite literally just went through this and you have to go through it all over again. I really felt for those kids. And then when you have a specialized major, like if you look at the Mount Ida kids with funeral services or the vet tech program, and they weren't offered anywhere else. So I know like for Newberry and Mount Ida, there were some colleges that were coming to the rescue, like UMass Dartmouth, you had an option of going there if you went to Mount Ida. And for Newberry, there was a variety of colleges that the, you know, students could choose from. But they chose to go to Newberry. They chose to go to Mount Ida. They didn't want to leave. So it's really tragic what's happening.
What was nice, I thought, was that the students that we spoke to at Newberry had all found a place. I think all of them, maybe one had not, that they were going to go to school, that they found their programs. And so they were going to be able to continue their career, because I think that's obviously the concern for these institutions and certainly for their families even more so. Were they going to be forced to stop their college career, or not forced to, but not even able to go to another institution. But most of them were, it seemed like.
I think they had almost accepted that, all right, as they said, they were angry, but then they kind of accepted it. For the most part, they were looking forward to starting over. There was one student in particular who just seemed to say, okay, this is a new beginning for me.
So I'm curious a little bit about you personally, because you're not all that far out of college. You've been gone, what, six years since you graduated?
Yeah, six
years
now.
Since you graduated. So some of this is a little fresh for you. And looking back on your own college experience, did this bring any thoughts to you about how you managed the process, how you managed it financially, how you managed it educationally, et cetera?
When I was assigned to this show, actually, I'll say the first thing that I did was look up the endowment for the school that I went to, because I would be so upset if it closed right now and I'm still paying off these student loans. Yes, I have a job, but if your school closes, it's, you know, your degree is from an institution that it no longer exists. That's a hard pill to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. Looking back, I think it was kind of, you know, you graduated from high school and you went to a four-year college, and, you know, the better the name of the college, you know, the more prestigious it is, the better off you would be. And I was a very average high school student. I had a C-plus average. My SAT scores were average.
You don't need to get personal here, Kevin.
I will get personal. I have no issue saying it. So I wasn't looking at going to a prestigious college. But I think that was my only option, a four-year degree. It was never proposed like, oh, well, you could go to community college for 2 years and then transfer to a state school. It was never, you could go and get a certificate program for, you know, a boot camp, or you could do this or that. It was, I had to go to a four-year degree. And then I ended up with a boatload of student loans, and I'm still paying them. But
I think that we all learned that a little bit in the process of this show, which is that education has been democratized in some sense by online learning, that you can go get certificates and degrees and education in many different forms and ways that maybe we're not locked into this sort of mindset that you just explained of graduate from high school, four-year college, get a job. That there are other ways to do this that are not only affordable, but have just as good an outcome.
I agree. I think it is important for high school students to know that there are other options than a four-year traditional college. You have other options. And I think it's important for people who understand that there are other options to educate these young people that they don't have to go through this path and end up with an enormous amount of debt.
Well, if nothing else, that's a good message to send to the students and parents and families out there that are going to be sending their kids to college in the years to come. All right, you did a great job on the show. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast, and we'll be back in a little bit with John Marcus.
Thank you for having me.
So, John Marcus from the Hechinger Report, thanks for coming into our podcast studio. And, you know, maybe take us back a little bit and give us the big picture of what's happening to these small colleges that are really struggling financially to the point that some of them are closing or looking for strategic partnerships.
Yeah, what isn't happening? It's just a number of things that are all coming down on these institutions all at the same time. The most significant problem for them is the demographics. We're just running out of 18 to 24-year-olds, especially in New England. So the Northeast and the Midwest are the places where the demographic decline is most significant. And so they're running out of customers. And we have an oversupply of colleges. There's a lot of colleges and universities, as people probably notice when they drive around here. There are too many of them. The price obviously has gone up to the point where you're now hearing people making determinations based on tuition and financial aid that's available to them. There are issues that result from the enrollment decline, the most significant being what's called the discount rate. That is the proportion of revenue from tuition that has to go back out the door in the form of discounts and financial aid just to fill seats. So all of those things are a problem now for colleges and universities. In Massachusetts, that's exacerbated by this new proposal, which we are all sort of referring to as the Mount Ida Law, which suggests that colleges and universities that are in financial difficulty have to tell us in advance, which becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So once you know a college is having financial difficulties, you don't enroll. And so that becomes a self-defeating kind of cycle.
So are these colleges victimized by not just those demographic trends, but also the fact that many of them have not diversified their revenue streams? They're solely dependent on their level of enrollment and the tuition they can get from each student.
That's right. Colleges and universities have essentially one product, which is education. Some of them are nibbling at the edges in ways that I think are very interesting just in terms of sort of an acknowledgement that they need to do this. So Niagara University near Niagara Falls put a bunch of its dorm rooms last summer on Airbnb because a lot of tourists go to Niagara Falls. It's a good way to generate a little bit of revenue. It's not going to change the equation, but it suggests that colleges are paying attention. Unity College in Maine was given a farm as a donation to use as part of its academic program. They also sell the produce that they raise, and they make their own ketchup, and they cater weddings. And other universities, 44 of them, this is my personal favorite, have licensed their logos for caskets. So if they have alumni that are particularly loyal, they can be buried in a casket that says University of North Carolina on it. None of those are enough to offset the problems that they're facing to and the degree that they're facing them on the revenue side. Their primary product is education, and they're running out of customers.
And so some of them I know think, wow, we should quickly jump into online education as if this might be a salvation. But from what we learned in our interviews, A, that's a very expensive proposition to get in. And if you're not already in there, you're probably not going to be able to get in there.
Only a small proportion of institutions that offer online higher education now are making money at it, although everybody else is trying to get in on it. The other complicating factor is a lot of online education is provided through a middleman. There are for-profit companies. One is called 2U. They take as much as 70% off the top as a commission to take your online program and then find the students and recruit them and provide it to them. So all of those potential new revenue sources are complicated, which leads them one other option, which is to cut costs. And that's very difficult if you're a college because you particularly have high labor costs on the teaching level. This is at least the company line at most of these institutions. They also do, however, tend to have a lot of administrators. The number of administrators at U.S. universities and colleges we've reported has doubled in the last 25 years at a time when enrollment has essentially been flat. Mount Ida, which closed, had a 156% increase in the number of administrators at a time that it was seeing a 12% decline in the number of students. So anyone that has been on a university or does business with a university sees a lot of assistant, associate, vice provosts for whatever that just add to layers and layers of people who are making pretty decent money, even though they're nonprofits, and who also pull down fairly significant benefits. So that's expensive, and that's what universities and colleges are going to have to do now.
You know, Southern New Hampshire University credits some of its success, especially in the online world, to the fact that they saw this coming in 1995, as they pointed out last night. Look, we looked at the demographic changes, we looked at the birth rates, and it was clear there was a crisis coming. Why didn't everybody else see this?
So that's a great point and a good question, and higher education is terrible at having anticipated this, because higher education didn't have this problem. They just had an endless supply of students, and so they didn't have to make any changes here. Even after 2008, when universities were particularly hard hit by the recession, their endowment returns were pathetic. If they were public, then their state budget appropriations went down, and they still kept adding administrators and still kept adding people. Part of the reason for that was that students kept coming. When the economy is bad and the unemployment rate is high, people tend to figure, well, I might as well go to college now because there's not a job. That's now reversed itself as the economy has improved and the enrollment has declined. There are 2.1 million fewer college students now than there were in 2011. Colleges and universities want you to think that they're extraordinarily competitive, and some of them are. And just recently we saw the acceptance numbers at places like Harvard, which are so tiny. That's such an exception to the rule. Most people go to colleges that are fairly non-selective. There are fewer of them now, fewer students. Colleges like to say that they're receiving record numbers of applications. But you have to listen very carefully to that sentence, because what they're not saying is record number of applicants. Each student is sending more applications per student. That doesn't mean that there are more students. There aren't. There are far fewer students. And so what that allows you to do as a family or as a student is to negotiate for more financial aid. That's why colleges don't want you to be aware of this. But now we're beginning to see with the closing of these colleges that they're out of students. They really haven't been very good at projecting forward. And if you look at Mount Ida, they were operating as if everything was fine, at least in public. They continued, as you know, to recruit new students and to offer a new contract to the faculty at a time when they were $68 million in debt at a university that had a $60 million a year operating budget. So there was no way that that was economically sustainable, but they just kept figuring, oh, it's all going to be fine. It's not going to be fine.
So in many ways, this is, in sort of financial terms, a market correction. But is there also a sense that, in addition to their lack of foresight, they're sort of getting their comeuppance for the glory years where the tuitions were increasing double digits in some cases year after year after year, and the American middle class was getting to the point of becoming bankrupt just to put one kid, let alone two, three, or four, through college?
I don't know if you'd call it getting their comeuppance, although I think a lot of people in the public might look at it this way, because colleges and universities, let's face it, they're a little bit elitist, they're smarter than we are, they do make pretty good money for work that's, I mean, kind of hard. I teach as an adjunct, it's hard work. But there's actually a lot of benefits that go along with it. In many institutions, you can send your own kid there for free. That makes it hard to really understand and gauge the level of pain that people are in. So I'm not sure it's comeuppance as much as it is sort of blindness to this problem. The other unfortunate reality of colleges and universities is that they're run by academics. And that has historically been understood to be a good thing, because university and college presidents historically were more concerned with the curriculum than they were with fundraising and operating budgets. Well, that's reversed now. And typically the route to college presidency goes through, you know, the faculty. And so a lot of people who are in charge of colleges and universities are academics who are surrounded by smart people and who are themselves quite smart, but maybe not exactly the right people for right now, when there needs to be a lot of kind of fiscal understanding of the problems and solutions.
And they're getting nibbled at the edges, too, in addition to the demographics. I mean, online education has also democratized education in a way and made it, if you want it to be, much less expensive than it was to go to a four-year institution where you might spend $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year at these elite institutions.
That's true. There's a lot of new competition that didn't exist before. Colleges have had a monopoly on the credential that you need to get a job, which is a university degree. That isn't true anymore. Employers are now accepting other kinds of credentials, certificates, which in fact universities and colleges are jumping to provide because they make money off of those. Other kinds of credentials. There are badges, which are credentials that reflect that you've completed some sort of online education. There are boot camps, coding boot camps, which are very short duration training programs that teach you basically just one thing. Are those all really necessarily a good direction for all of us as a society? Maybe not, because there's a lot to be said for understanding sort of how the world works and knowing how to be knowing how to solve problems and work in teams and communicate. Those are things you learn from colleges and universities, including liberal arts colleges and universities, the ones that are right now under quite a lot of pressure. But they're not very good at making that case for themselves. And so they're getting their lunch eaten by all of these new competitors.
I think that's where I was going sort of with the value proposition is that, is this the only path to success? For many years, that was what we were told, that you had to go get your bachelor's degree at least, and you had to get it from a good institution, and the better institution you got it from, the better off you would be. And that's the value proposition I was asking, is the middle class sort of saying enough, not only because they're seeing other options, but because it doesn't, at that expense, at $70,000 a year, it just doesn't look financially viable anymore.
The middle class is saying enough, not just the middle class. People are looking at the price and questioning the return on that investment. And that motivates people to behave in several ways. One is that they will forego a more expensive college for a lower priced, for instance, public university that has just as good a program and not the prestige. We've always put a huge premium on prestige, especially those of us in this part of the world where you can't walk down a street without seeing all the college stickers in the back of the Volvos. That's been important to people, and I think that's changing. If you look at, there is a survey that's produced by UCLA of incoming freshmen nationwide, and significant proportions of them had a first-choice college in mind and ended up not going there because of the price. That's on the one hand kind of sad. We've always said in America that if you tried hard enough and worked hard and were smart enough, you could accomplish anything. It's no longer true if it ever was. You can't go to some of these institutions. They're simply out of your financial ability to pay.
Taking you back a little bit to where we started, is the tipping point that demographic change? Is it the financial cost at $70,000 a year? Is it a combination of all those things? Where do you see it sort of the seminal moment where things shifted here? Or was it 2008 in the financial crisis?
It is a combination of things. I do think, just sort of having watched this as a journalist who covers higher education, that the enrollment wasn't the first problem. The first problem was twofold. One was the endowment returns were negative after 2008, and that significantly affected a lot of these institutions. Some of them don't even have particularly big endowments. Those that do rely heavily, for example, as you may recall, Harvard had their huge expansion was scheduled to begin. That giant piece of land in Alston that they cleared, they ended up not building anything on it for years because of poor returns on their endowment. And their endowment is the size of some small countries. So imagine how that affected smaller colleges and universities. The second aspect of that is related to the demographic. It's that discount rate, which is now on average nationwide, 49% of income, of revenue at colleges is going out the door as discounts. It's some of these institutions that have closed. It's in the 65 to 70% range. You cannot survive. So those were the first things that hit, and they were still able to kind of scrape their way to filling seats. It's hard now.
So what do you see going forward? Mount Ida has closed. Newberry is closing. Hampshire's up in the air. For the Northeast in particular, what do you see going forward? Are we going to see more colleges, small colleges like this, in financial trouble and closing?
There's no question. There'll be more colleges that are closing. This demographic reversal isn't going to stop. It's going to go on for too long for some of these institutions to survive. You're going to see a lot of innovation, too. I just did a story about Nichols College, which is in Dudley near the Connecticut border, which did see this coming. And in fact, although their president is an academic, she's a business management professor who previously worked at Babson and has actually been very forward-thinking about how do we preempt this. And I met her at a conference of college presidents at which one president in the back of the room stood up and said sort of the same thing I hear all the time, which is there's nothing left to cut. We've cut to the bone. And she stood up in the front and said, I beg to differ. There's a lot of things that we can do. So they have done some of the obvious things. They've significantly increased their fundraising, which has worked. But they've also studied their staffing on the administrative side and combined certain services or used technology to provide services that previously required lots of people. So that saved a lot of money. They are expanding their curriculum or their offerings, their majors, but without hiring new faculty. So they take math faculty and data faculty and create a data analytics program. Math and marketing, and they create a marketing analytics program. And so those are really good ideas. And those are ways, you know, they also aren't spending a lot of money. I hadn't been to Nichols College when I went to visit there to do this story. It's in surprisingly good shape, much better condition than you find a lot of other small colleges these days around New England. But they've done it economically. They built a beautiful new, very environmentally sensitive new classroom building for $12 million, which the president told us at another university would have cost $50 to $60 million, just because they kind of planned it smarter. And so that's that kind of thing I think you'll see a little more of in the colleges that survive.
And what about the loss of intellectual capital, which we depend on here in the Northeast? We depend on our higher education community as well, and the business that it brings, the tourism that it brings, the everything that comes at the end of that process, where we do have these kids who are well-educated and who stay in the region. Do you see that this is a threat to our economy, or one of the foundations of our economy?
This is so important, and I'm still waiting to see policymakers stand up and say, we need to help. Because higher education is one of the four biggest industries in Massachusetts. We've seen a lot of damage already. And although the colleges that are closing don't necessarily affect the sort of the intellectual capital of research and spin-off companies that come from places like Harvard and MIT, they're not going anywhere. But they still do support significant payrolls. They have multiplier effects in their communities. Often they're in rural towns like Dudley. They're pretty much the biggest employers in these communities. That's important here, and we don't seem to be paying attention to the potential damage that we're doing. I mean, this is what we have. We don't have natural resources for the most part here in Massachusetts. We have brains, and we have smart people, and we have colleges and universities. People, almost joke about the concentration of colleges in Boston. If we begin to lose that, that's a significant problem.
And lastly, I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball. This whole college admissions scandal that has blown up and has been generated from here at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, what kind of an impact do you see that having on families as they begin to prepare their applications for the kids that are seniors in college and next year's class and the year after that? Do you think there's an effect to this at all that's significant?
I don't know if it's going to affect individual families or students that are applying to college, other than to make them angry, as they ought to be. I think there's two impacts of the admission scandal. One is voyeuristic. We all like to see powerful and wealthy, famous people sort of brought down to earth, as happened here. And of course, this sort of reinforces our perception that they get advantages that we don't have. On the other hand, what I hope is that we don't forget the vision that this gave us, the glimpse this gave us into the socioeconomic divide in higher education, because this is almost all we cover. For years, we've been covering this. Rich kids go to really good universities. Poor kids, no matter how smart, end up at community colleges and second-tier publics that spend a lot less money on them, support them a lot less. It makes no logical sense. You have the kids that come from the best private and suburban public high schools who already arrive in college extremely well prepared, going to the colleges that provide them with the most support, and very smart lower income students, often also racial and ethnic minorities and first generation, who went to really crappy public high schools, urban public high schools often, and sometimes rural, ending up at colleges that can't help them at all. They just don't have the budget for it. This divide in higher education is heartbreaking, and because, I mean, we see this every day. And if this admission scandal brings some attention to this, or at least reinforces our understanding of it, then at least there'll be one good thing that comes out of it.
John Marcus of the Hechinger Report, thanks for joining us. Thanks for educating us today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. And that's Chronicle the Podcast. Thank you for listening. Let us know what you think on social media at Chronicle5 on Twitter and Instagram. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode of Chronicle the Podcast.